So one thing that is your recent extremely deep interest in privacy and how computing can help.
We'll get there, yes. I want to just mention a couple of names. So the first person who worked on a new proof of the infinite automaton, infinite trees problem was, as I said, Charles Dyckhoff. And then somewhat later, maybe 10 years later, Yuri Gurevich and somebody called Harrington, I forget his first name. Harrington is at Berkeley. And then Emerson had a proof, and several other people. That was a problem that people returned to time and again because of its applications. So what would be next? I came from the year 1982 onwards. I was dividing my time between the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, one term in Jerusalem, and one term at Harvard University, I got some of the work that I described. Many of the applications of randomness was already done while I was at Harvard, in Jerusalem and at Harvard, for example, the Byzantine Agreement problem and other applications of randomization. And I became interested in while at Harvard, I became interested in applications of randomized algorithms to parallel computing. Let's say in the mid-80s, somewhat later, application of the parallel algorithms were of quite central interest, and the solutions were usually in the synchronized framework. So one would consider, for example, the PRAM model, parallel random access machine model, was inherently a synchronized model. So one day Krishna Pale and Svi Kellen, by previous arrangement, marched into my office at Harvard in the old Aiken lab and suggested that we work together on asynchronous parallel computing, and that most likely randomization is going to be useful there. So it turned out to be the case, and it turned out that, again, problems that could not be solved by deterministic, classical parallel algorithms could be solved by use of randomization. And we wrote a series of papers where we have shown that you can achieve a very high level of parallelism by employing randomization. So the people who were involved in those papers, in addition to me, were Aumann and, as I said before, Kevin and Pallet. We also built at Harvard actually an implementation of an implementation of a parallel cluster based on these randomized algorithms. Maybe the next very significant application of parallelism of randomization was to cryptography. Maurer in Zurich suggested a model of a cryptographic system that is based on what he called the bounded storage assumption. Namely, you have a public source, very intense source of random bits, which everybody can observe, say beamed down from a satellite. And then a sender and a receiver have a short common key that they establish, say, by meeting. And they use that key in order to select the same random bits out of the public source of randomness. And out of those bits, they construct so-called one-time pads. And then, if you assume that the intensity of the random source is so large that no adversary can store, no matter what they try to do, more than, let us say, two-thirds of those bits, then the one-time pad is really completely random to the adversary and can be used for provably unbreakable encryption. Now, in Maurer's original work, he showed the result, the unbreakability result, under the assumption that the adversary is storing bits. However, there was an open question that assume that he can perform a computer, he can in fact perform in real time, say, a computation on those bits. Let's say take the XOR of every three successive bits and store these XORs, which now constitute just one-third in number of the bits that are originally, are initially beamed down. Whether under the assumption of a computationally unbounded, storage-bounded adversary, the method remains provably unbreakable. So, Jonathan Aumann in my Jerusalem part of the year came into my office, and he was working on that problem with some people at the Weizmann Institute, and they didn't get any result, and suggested that he and I work together. And within a very short time, I was able to get an initial result showing that, in fact, you get unbreakable, provably unbreakable encryption. And then we continued to work on that problem later on together with a student of mine, not you, Dol, you. I have to distinguish between two. Jan Zonding, sorry, with Jan Zonding, and we proved a series of results giving various examples of unbreakable codes which are based on the bounded storage assumption. This work created quite a stir, was widely quoted even in the popular press all over the world at the time. Now, to continue the line of the discussion of provably unbreakable encryptions, because of the incredible advances in storage technology, where you can now buy 200, 300 gigabyte hard disk for, I don't know, for a few dollars. The bounded storage assumption is not clearly realistic, because maybe that in the competition between generation and broadcast of random disk bits, and the ability for somebody with, you know, a few tens of millions of dollars to store all of these bits, it may be that the adversary who is trying to store everything really has the upper hand. So later on my own, I formulated a bounded access assumption. I was considering a model for an encryption method that consists of a few thousand, let's say 10,000, 20,000, but actually even 5,000 participants generate and store on their computers a few thousand physically random pages. And now we call those page server nodes. And now the sender and receiver share initially a relatively small random key, and they employ that common random key to asynchronously in time, randomly select the same page server node, and from there to request the same page. So they collect a certain number of random pages, and then they XOR those pages in groups of, let's say, 30 to create one-time pairs. And now the limited access assumption is the following, that an adversary cannot listen to more, cannot monitor or subvert more than, let us say, 2,000 of the 10,000 page server nodes in the network of page server nodes. So consequently, his probability of having obtained any particular random page is no more than 1/5. And since the pages are XORed in groups of 30, his probability of having all of them is 1/5 to the power of 30. And if he is missing even one of those pages, then the one-time pad is completely random with respect to him, to the adversary, and consequently, if used to encrypt by XORing the message is also completely random. Now one can say, just parenthetically, that all right, but if the sender and receiver are considered to be sufficiently important to the adversary, then the adversary can monitor their computers and see which pages they download. However, a person who is using that system can take a small, even handheld device walk over to, let's say, to Starbucks cafe somewhere, and within 15 minutes download several thousand pages. And it is really impractical to assume that, you know, everybody can be followed around and monitored at all times, and thereby defeated in this secrecy and privacy. So this method was implemented by a group of students, brilliant students at Harvard, and now the code, which was a little bit flaky, because these people were maybe a little bit better in mathematics than in coding, is now being strengthened by a student common to Ron Revest and me, and we are hoping to field that, not for profit, to field that method, say, within the coming half year or so. And that is an example of a provably unbreakable encryption method. Now, how many years ago? Six or so years ago, Dennis Shasha came to me and suggested that we work together on devising a system for preventing privacy of, to begin with, of software, but later on also music, videos, and so on, any kind of digitized intellectual property.
Preventing piracy, not privacy.
Yeah, yes. Preventing piracy. So we started on by looking, essentially reinventing or trying variants of existing methods, such as the use of safe co-processors and other methods which were actually current at the time, are still current now, and which, by the way, were all defeated one way or another. And then we devised a new approach, an entirely new approach, that consisted of having methods for very robustly identifying, for example, software, even if an adversary takes that software and tries to change it by changing notations, indices, and the like. So, and then we extended it to the identification of music and of videos. The details don't matter, but we really had have very robust and quick and computationally efficient methods for identifying content. And then we also devised privacy maintaining and protecting methods for enabling people, users, to get permissions for use of that intellectual property, of that digitized content. So a person can get a token, how did we call those?
A tag,
allowing him use. And the tag is stored on the computer. And very paradoxically, the person can purchase the tag and maintain it without actually revealing his identity. So that, for example, if we talk about an architectural firm getting or an engineering firm getting or wanting to obtain or to win a contest to build a bridge, they can download software for a certain system for bridge design without identifying themselves, so that competitors don't know that they are in the game of trying to compete for the project of building that bridge. So, and in the same way, people can download movies or whatever without identifying themselves. This is covered by a number of patents, is a very robust and complete system. It required the cooperation of operating system vendors in order to be deployed, and therefore various justified or unjustified real-life reasons, it was not possible to obtain that cooperation. So that was one foray into the realm of both protection of intellectual property, but however also into the realm of protecting privacy of users of that digital content. Goes without saying that this would apply mutatis mutandis also to the downloading of books and so on, any kind of digitized content. Now, more recently, I became interested in protecting the privacy and secrecy of auctions. Stuart Schieber was working with a very good person at Harvard, David Parks, an expert on e-commerce, including auctions. And Stuart felt that there is a place for cryptography in that area, and his initial thought was using cryptography to somehow evaluate the efficacy of various auction mechanisms. But he came and suggested I join their group, and then we incorporated somebody who eventually became a joint student, Chris Thorpe, who became a joint student eventually of David Parks and myself. And I wanted and had a methodology for employing cryptography in order to enable an auctioneer to conduct the auction in a way that is clearly honest, prevents various subversions of the auction process itself. And later on, when the auction is completed and the auctioneer has determined the winner or winners and how much they pay and how much they get of whatever is being auctioned in multi-item auctions, the auctioneer can publish a privacy-preserving proof for the correctness of the result. So in the initial papers that we wrote on that, there were three maybe papers, we used the tool of so-called homomorphic encryptions that was that was gave a solution and provided a solution to the problem was but was computationally very, very heavy and inefficient. And later on, I had an idea that I then worked, that I then eventually implemented with Chris Thorpe and Rocco Servadio, of an entirely new approach to zero-knowledge proofs, which is computationally very efficient, does not use heavy-handed and computationally expensive encryption, but achieves everything very efficiently and very transparently by use of just well-known hash functions. I want to say a few words on a number of great teachers that have influenced me. I think that almost without exception, assuming that I am a successful scientist, that in the life of scientific life of every successful scientist, you'll find some really outstanding teachers that have influenced him or her and directly or indirectly played a role in their success. So I'm going to mention two teachers, just mentioning them very briefly. My first mentor was a very eminent logician and set theorist, Abraham Halevi Frankel, and he in a sense discovered me and brought me to the university. And then I wrote a master's thesis, which I think I've mentioned before, under the direction of a wonderful algebraist called Jacob Levitsky. He himself was a student of maybe the greatest woman mathematician ever, Amy Noether. The creator of modern algebra, modern abstract algebra as we know it today. And in that thesis I solved an open problem. I may have mentioned it before, master's thesis. I solved an open problem due to Amy Noether. Then in Jerusalem I had a teacher in applied mathematics called Menachem Schiffer, a very great mathematician and no less great teacher. He used to lecture on the most complex topics without notes. Before class, when I came in, I saw him pacing back and forth in the corridor, mumbling to himself and sort of rehearsing maybe parts of what he has to say. And then he would come and pour out the most beautiful mathematics, for example, in this case, differential equations, onto the blackboard. Absolutely beautiful, both in content and in presentation, without a single mistake. And in addition, he was really the most wonderful, friendly, imaginable teacher. I then went to...
Excuse me, let me just interrupt for a second. Let's talk a little bit about the relationship that you've mentioned to me often between being a good teacher and being a good researcher, because you've been an excellent teacher, have won many awards as teaching as well as for science. Just how do you think academics should view their teaching responsibilities?
This is really a wonderful and a very important question. there is that legend or whatever misconception that somehow there is a conflict and maybe even a contradiction between great teaching and being able to do great science. I think this is completely incorrect, and that this wonderful teaching, such as Schiffer's teaching, flows from a really deep understanding of the subject matter. And this is what enables the person also to correctly select what to teach. After all, the world of knowledge, even, you know, in particular specialized subjects, is almost infinite. So one great contribution is to select the topics. And the other great contribution is to really understand the essence, the main motifs of each particular thing that the person presents, and to show it to the class in a way that the class gets these essential ideas in each of these, for each of these topics. And therefore, unless there are some maybe personality problems, maybe problems of not being articulate, maybe problems of being careless and not paying attention and not attaching importance to the students and to the teaching, unless one of these factors, you know, plays a role, great teaching and great science really flow together and are not contradictory or exclusive of each other. And Schiffer was an example of that. I mean, not only that he was a great teacher, but he was also a very, very great mathematician. Speaking of that, I think that one of the main, maybe the main, or rather one of the two main benefits of for a student to go to a great university is, on the one hand, being together with wonderful students, colleagues, students, because of the selection process. And the other one is to learn material, whether it's history or law or mathematics or physics, to learn material, to learn a subject from people who don't just read a book and teach you the next chapter in that book, but from people who had an essential contribution to the innovations that are being presented in class. Because again, they are the people who really know from personal experience what is the essence of what is being taught. So let us say, to come somewhere and to study with Ken Elrond, or let us say at Harvard with what's the name of the philosopher who wrote the theory of justice?
Rawls.
To study with the Rawls. You know, this is an experience that is unequal to studying with somebody who read Rawls' book and is teaching it to you. When I came to Princeton, I had a wonderful life. Almost everybody on the faculty was a world famous mathematician. And of course, I studied with Church, one of the three initiators of the theory of computability. So Turing, Church, and Gödel, two of whom were still alive and in Princeton. So I studied with Alonzo Church. The most charismatic teacher was the algebraist Emil Artin, himself the world is small and everybody is connected to everybody. Himself a student of Eminato, who was an absolutely world-class algebraist. He would lecture without notes, giving the absolutely most beautiful lectures. I studied algebraic number theory. Absolutely most beautiful, illuminating lectures on algebraic number theory. And this was just an unparalleled experience to sit in class with those students who were sitting with me and to listen to that teacher. Later on, I wrote a thesis combining computability. I mentioned that before, computability in algebra, namely on the unsolvability, computational unsolvability of certain algebraic problems in group theory. And Gödel somehow heard about that. And this is sort of amusing. Gödel was a reclusive person. And among other things, one of his peculiarities was he didn't want to use the telephone. So one day I come into the math department, everybody is absolutely excited. Kurt Gödel came and asked about you, they said to me. He wants to invite you to the Institute for Advanced Study. And I became his, and so I spent a year as an instructor at Princeton and a year at the Institute for Advanced Study. And during that year I had a weekly meeting with Gödel. I think that officially I was his assistant, research assistant. I didn't contribute anything to his research. But once a week we had an hourly meeting which was incredibly illuminating, you know, one of the absolutely greatest minds in the 20th century. So, that is it.
Great, well, thank you very much.